What I will be doing is talking about sort of the general geology of Iceland, then talking about a specific situation that McPhee writes about, and then reading actually from some of McPhee's writings on this situation in Iceland. Now, I have two apologies. One, I'm probably not going to pronounce everything just right. And secondly, some of my slides are taken from photographs and books, and that will be apparent a couple of times. You'll see the seam in the page, just as the seam runs down through here. But we'll still go on because there's some great pictures. As I said, Iceland is a very unique setting geologically. Let me stop for a minute. Is that
it's
enough fine. Light?
I can see it, no problem.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay, unique geologic setting, often called the land of ice and fire. And this map shows a number of the glaciers which cover Iceland. And we can see that there really is extensive ice cover in some regions. And then the fire comes from the volcanic activity, which we'll see in some of the slides. Iceland is located just south of the Arctic Circle. It has an area about the size of the state of Pennsylvania. It's located on the Mid-Atlantic Ridge. Now, these are features which run through the ocean basins. These are the ridges. And Iceland then sits here in the northern part of the Atlantic. I'm sorry, we'll see a better slide of the Atlantic later. For those of you who have heard some of my previous talks, you've heard a lot about plate tectonics. Plate tectonics is a theory which has evolved to explain a lot of the geology that we observe in the world. And the theory is that the surface of the Earth is divided into a number of plates or pieces, surface pieces, that move independently of one another. We can see here Iceland sits at the boundary between two plates, the North American plate and the Eurasian plate, and at this plate boundary, the two plates are then moving apart and creating new material between them. And I can show you a close-up here of the Atlantic. This is the ridge, and the two plates are then moving apart at this ridge. Iceland is one of the only places in the world where we actually have the ridge exposed at the surface. And you can see here that Iceland is a mass which sits on the ridge itself. Just in cross-section, we can see then what is happening at a ridge is these two plates move apart from one another and new material comes up and is added onto these plates as it cools. So that's what's happening in Iceland, is it's sitting in the middle, and in the middle of Iceland, we're then constantly adding new material. In fact, Iceland is becoming wider at a rate of about 2 centimeters a year, which means that since the first settlement in Iceland, about 900 AD, Iceland has increased in width by about 20 meters. That means it also is 20 meters wider across the Atlantic.
Help me with the conversion from metric. Thank you.
This distance on your thumb is 2.5 centimeters.
2.5.
Excuse me.
A meter is about 39 inches.
That's right.
A little more than a yard.
Right.
Okay. Right. So, and it's grown by 20 meters?
20 meters, so 70 feet.
Or 20 yards, or thereabouts?
Yeah. That's right. It's not a lot, but that's increased acreage for the.
It's measurable.
That's right. Since we have a member of the group here who is deaf, let's raise our hand if we want to ask a question, okay? All right. The other thing which is quite unique about Iceland is that it sits on top of what we call a hot spot. And Hawaii is an example of a hot spot also. If we were to look at this from the interior of the Earth, we have a small source of molten material coming to the surface, and it creates this volcano on the surface. And then the plate, the Pacific plate, moves across this source of molten material and adds a new volcano. So if we look at the chain, Hawaii is the youngest island, and as we move away, the islands in the chain become older and older as the plate has carried them away. So Iceland has this combination of sitting on a mid-Atlantic ridge and the hotspot. The result is a lot of volcanoes and a lot of volcanic activity in Iceland. We can see here a map of Iceland that shows some of the areas where there are active volcanoes. These various names give names to some of them. I will show you a picture of Hekla, the volcano there. We'll also be looking down here in particular at the volcanoes which are outlined in this portion of the map. What we see here in the shaded area is the portion that we call the rift on Iceland, where the actual separation of the two parts of Iceland are. So, to the northwest, we have the North American plate, and to the southeast, we have the Eurasian plate. So just a few pictures of the volcanoes. This is Hekla, the volcano that I pointed out before. There have been on the order of 14 or so eruptions in Iceland, a number of them here in the last century. Then some of the other eruptions have taken place along this region. This is called the Laki fissure. Craters, L-A-K-I. And the, basically this rift has all, these volcanoes have formed since about 1783. Now, the next part of my story will be coming down to talk about these islands down here. It's an archipelago called the Vestmannaeyjar Islands, V-E-S-T-M-A-N-N-A-E-Y-J-A-R. And this is a continuation then of this rift that we saw before. The separation of the two plates occurs along this line, and then the Vestman Islands are down here at the southwest trend of this rift. It's a series of about 15 islands and 60 or so submarine craters created primarily in the last 10,000 to 15,000 years. Now Surtsey, S-U-R-T-S-E-Y, which is, let's see, Surtsey is down here. Surtsey is perhaps the better known of all of the Vestman Islands because it began an eruption phase in 1963 and built an island out of the sea. There were a lot of films of this eruption that took place. I have a couple slides here. It grew through the accumulation of ash and pumice. And the white is steam. This is not an ash cloud as Mount St. Helens produced, but steam from the molten material and the hot material encountering the seawater. So we have been reminded that the Vestman Islands were a location of geologic activity during these eruptions in 1963. But it still came as a bit of a surprise to the islanders in Heimaey, which is the largest, down here, the largest of the Vestman Islands, when an eruption there began in 1973. If we look at a view of the city called Heimaey, on the Vestman, here on the large island of Heimaey, we can see that there was a volcano in the background. This one was called Helgafell, H-E-L-G-A-F-E-L-L. Large community here, dependent primarily on fishing. About 2.5% of Iceland's population lived in this small community, yet it produced 1/12 of Iceland's export income. Fishing of haddock and cod and capon. Also, there was some farming in this region on the island. You can see some of the outlying farms of these fields. And there were some bird rookeries, and which the eggs and birds from this region were also captured. The last time this volcano, Helgafell, had been active was sometime about 5,000 or 6,000 years ago. So this community lived here in a certain amount of security, knew the volcano was there, but hadn't been threatened by it. The eruption began January 23rd, 1973, on the flanks of Helgafell, down on the side of the mountain here. And it had been preceded by a series of small earthquakes, and as the eruption progressed, they evacuated the entire town. A population of on the order of 5,000 were removed within 4 hours and taken to the mainland. A couple of pictures of the eruption itself. We can see it here down on the flanks. Huge cloud of ash and steam of material. Lava then flowed in this direction, initially towards the sea, producing this enormous cloud of steam that accompanied the ash. There was also a lava fountain, which accompanied this eruption. The lava fountain reached a height of about 500 feet, and an estimated total amount of 3 million cubic yards of material fell on the town. That's about 6 times the amount that fell on Pompeii. There were also lava flows, as well as the loose material. This is a picture of lava which we call A-A, which is simply A-A. And it is a very blocky type of lava. It advances very, very slowly. And so this wall of lava is actually flowing outwards towards these people. But because it moves so slowly, they can be this close to it and watch it as it moves. Flowing in the speeds of just a few meters per hour, and the flow itself was on the order of a mile long, but didn't feel particularly threatening originally, and the eruption ended in June of 1973. You can see that in this picture, as the eruption continues here on the flank, that there is now a black coating which appears to cover much of the town, and that is because of all the loose ash and cinders which have fallen. And I'll show you a couple of pictures of that kind of thing later on. As a result of this eruption, a new volcano was added on the flanks. This is the picture of Heimaey prior to the eruption. And this is the picture after the eruption. This was Helgafell that was there before. The new volcano of almost the same height was called Eldfell, E-L-D-F-E-L-L. And all of this material is now new material, which flowed down from this volcano and, in fact, covered part of the city. About a third of the houses were destroyed by either ash or flow, actually covering them over. Somewhere in the order of 400 houses. And if we look at an aerial view down, this was Helgafell prior to the eruption, and the town, our other views, had looked down in this direction. We now can look at an aerial photograph after the eruption. The new volcano was built here, and all of this area has now been added on to the island from the eruption, increasing the land area by about a square mile, or 20% in area on the island. A number of flows, as we saw, actually threatened the town, threatened this eastern margin of the town. And a geophysicist who had actually started his career as a nuclear physicist from the mainland had the idea that there was perhaps a way to control the path of the flow of lava. He had tried it briefly in some studies on Surtsey, and he now sort of took on this task during the eruption here in Heimaey. His name, do you want to look at it? Thorbjorn Sigurdsson.
Big name.
We'll call him Thorbjorn from now on. He got together a group who sprayed water onto the lava as it flowed. This is a picture then. They had enormous hoses where they pumped seawater up and then sprayed it against the advancing flow of lava to attempt to cool or freeze that lava before it then threatened the town. Lava is at about a temperature of 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit, and what they needed to do was cool it to the point where it was solid, and it takes about a cubic meter of water to cool about 7/10 of a cubic meter of lava. They used hoses, pipe, pumps to bring the seawater up, and then they in fact had to use bulldozers to push some of the material. You can see that there was once a house in this location. They had platoons of workers, about 75 at a time, from a volunteer crew of close to 500. They worked during the only 3 hours of natural light that they had in the month of February. A lot of hazards at this time, falling ash, what we call volcanic bombs of material, but they had a huge network to spray here on the lava. Now, this author, John McPhee, visited Iceland in 1988. He spent a lot of time talking to the people who'd been involved in this, and he writes about the events of 1973 in his book, The Control of Nature. This book is actually over here in the bookstore. It's not on the table where the books are that are recommended in classes. It's in their regular stock. He writes about three different efforts to control nature. One deals with the Mississippi River, one deals with debris flows in Los Angeles, and one story deals with these lava flows in Iceland. And what I would like to do is read some of the sections out of this book that deal with this problem of trying to control the flow of nature. Now, the first reading will simply talk about this idea of spraying the water on and trying to control it. About a fortnight after the eruption began, Thorbjorn and his mates went out for the first time to water the lava. They chose a position on the shoreline, roughly 1,000 feet outside the mouth of the harbor. The harbor was a long wedge-like cove, open to the east, and its mouth was defined by a pair of offset breakwaters, reaching in from the two sides. As it happened, there could not have been a more public place in which to conduct the lava cooling experiment. Across the harbor, behind the firemen and their hoses, was Storaklif, S-T-O-R-A-K-L-I-F. A flat-top sea stack, about 700 feet high, rising sheer from the water. On its summit was the apparatus that normally received television signals from the mainland and bent them down towards the island. Now a television camera on top of Storaklif was reversing the process. Unblinking, never panning, it stared at the new volcano and the intervening lava. The scene was broadcast by Iceland's lone television station 19 hours a day. As the hoses made their trajectories against the dark advancing mass and the water blew away as steam, Thorbjorn could, of course, not hear their laughter. The volcano was shooting ash straight up 5 miles. Where lava was entering the sea, bright white steam went 5 miles upward too, joining en route the darker volcanic cloud. Who could not agree that the odds seemed to favor nature? Thorbjorn was impressed by the early results of his experiment. Where the hoses had played on the lava, its movement was arrested, while the unwatered flow on either side moved on, forming lobes, somewhat like breasts, somewhat like eyeglasses. After all the intervening years, Thorbjorn, recalling this, still seemed pleasantly surprised. "We were having some effect," he said. "It solidified, it stood still." Obviously, the town itself felt very threatened by this advancing flow of lava. But the greatest risk of all was not to the town itself, but was in fact to the harbor. If you remember from the description, what we have is, oh, actually, back up a moment, oops. This was the title page from the article called Cooling the Lava by McPhee that originally appeared in New Yorker magazine. It's now part of the book. Some of you who have read New Yorker may recall having seen this, but you can see the wonderful sketch that shows the town after the eruption and how much of it is covered over. This also shows us the harbor and the two breakwaters that were being described, a view of the harbor then before the eruption, shows us that boats came into a very protected area. Well, the flow threatened the harbor very dramatically. And the second reading that I would like to do is describe this flow as it advances towards the harbor. Remember that a 1/12 of Iceland's income, export income, depends upon this harbor. The harbor is essential for the safety of the fishing fleet, and if this harbor is then destroyed, it will reduce the ability to fish in this area. This was the breakwater nearer the volcano, extending like a finger halfway across the harbor mouth. Continually hammered by wind-driven waves, the harbor wall was in need of repair and was about to get it. As the weight of the dislodged mountainside squeezed forth fresh pulses of underlying lava, the threat to the harbor redoubled. The pumping and cooling operation, still not taken seriously by the majority of Icelanders watching it on television, became desperate. Lava moving along shore at the rate of 100 feet a day was obviously going to reach the breakwater and then likely cross it and fill the harbor. This seemed so probable that the Civil Defense Council once again ordered all boats away. Big nozzles on tripods were lined up on the breakwater like cannons on a deck. When the lava had covered the final distance and was looming very near, water trajectories could reach up over the front and more effectively soak the top. For 4 days, the future of the harbor remained doubtful as the ships and the land-based pumps engaged in their push of war, while behind the lava front, the oncoming flow buckled as it tested the resistance of the cooled margin. Then, wondrously, a condition of equipoise was achieved, a standoff, during which the lobes spread to the left and to the right and filled in the sea bottom on the outside of, but next to, the breakwater. The volume of lava grew, and the front became higher, but held. The lava stopped. It stopped 1 foot short of going over the harbor wall, Magnuson told me, M-A-G-N-U-S. M-A-G-N-U-S-S-O-N. No stone went over the top of it, August Erlingson said, A-G-U-S-E-R-L-I-N-G-S-S-O-N. I saw one stone roll on top of it and stop. I saw 3 or 4 stones perhaps fall into the harbor, nothing more. The breakwater, which had seen its last wave, was no longer a breakwater. It was now the lining of the inner harbor, of a new high headland occupying one side of the entrance to the harbor. So this is one breakwater, this is the other breakwater, and the huge lobe which came down into the harbor. Probably gave it better protection than the old breakwater had. The original harbor opening had been 1.2 miles wide. After this flow had come down into this region, it was narrowed to about 500 feet. Along with this flow of lava down from the side of the volcano came an enormous chunk that had broken off the side of the volcano. It was heading northward again towards the harbor and towards the homes, and was seen as a large threat because it was so huge that it had a lot of inertia and could simply keep on traveling, where the flow itself could be stopped at its margins. And the final reading that I'd like to do from McPhee describes this large chunk as it traveled down. Like an iceberg that had calved off a glacier, The great bulk of the north side of the volcano remained afloat in a molten sea. It was a mountain itself, and moreover, it moved. It was landscape on the loose, an incongruous itinerant alp. Its summit high above the lava plain, it's heading north by northwest. The mobile mountain had a 9-acre base and a sharp peak. It weighed 2 million tons. I've never figured out how they really knew that. People looking up from almost any street in town could see its silhouette filling the sky. Today in one place, tomorrow in another. Someone named it Flakkarin, F-L-A-K-K-A-R-I-N-N. And no one ever called it anything else but Flakkarin the Wanderer. If all of this had happened on a different vector, it might have been merely entertaining, but Flakkarin was headed for the harbor. If one of its advance waves had nearly overtopped the harbor wall, as this flow here, what might be expected when Flakkarin itself arrived at the same place? When the wanderer reached the harbor might become a hill. A plan was developed to stop Flakkarin. The dramatics at the harbor wall had amply demonstrated that pumped seawater could affect both the motion and the final position of the right kind of lava. The strategy was straightforward. Select an area of the lava lying in Flakkarin's path and pump enough water onto it to get beneath the surface rind and increase in size and number the columnar cracks that characterize basalt as it cools. Then more seawater, saturating through those cracks, would reach all the way to the impermeable molten center of the flow, solidifying an overall mass sufficient to block Flakkarin. Something close to 30 million gallons of seawater was poured onto one chosen area to prepare it to repel Flakkarin. As test drillings eventually substantiated, the volume of basalt that solidified for this purpose was about the size of Yankee Stadium. Toward it, Flakkarin kept coming, toward the chilled lava and beyond at the harbor. The crash was rock buckling, full tilt, head on, tectonic. After spinning halfway around, Flakkarin broke into pieces and no longer moved. I would love to have seen this event. I would love to have seen the eruption because it would be fascinating geologically, but the human effort that went into dealing with this, and truly the ingenuity to think up this idea to use the resource of the water to stop this impending flow and the threat is really remarkable. The results of this eruption and the efforts to stop the flow in the directions toward the settlement was about 6 million cubic meters of seawater that were sprayed on. At the peak of the eruption in February, they were using about 1.3 million gallons of seawater per day. Water was sprayed over a period of 103 days and cooled somewhere greater than 5 million cubic yards of lava to a depth of about 10 meters. In addition to cooling the lava, they left somewhere on the order of 200,000 tons of salt, since it was salt water. The efforts cost about $1.5 million to use the equipment and the time. However, in the end, it probably brought a $30 million savings in heat to this community. And the next thing that I'm going to talk about is actually this geothermal resource that they have here. Provided a lot of new paving material for the community, provided a better harbor, and the population returned and resumed their life in this area. Now,
question?
Yes, question.
You said paving material?
The lava makes great paving material. You can crumple it and it makes a small black rock that you can spread and is a very durable surface.
Asphalt, just like asphalt, right?
Different composition, but same purpose. That's right.
Question.
Yes.
What do they do with the salt?
It just leaves the salt there. The salt will dissolve with the precipitation.
Right.
Any of us who this volcano is one which flows fairly smoothly.
The Hawaiian lava, though, is it thinner than this?
It flows in two ways. As the blocky and also as a smoother flowing lava that we see forming kind of a ropey surface, which is called Pahoehoe, P-A-H-O-E-H-O-E. But it's very different from Mount St. Helens material. Mount St. Helens material, very thick and very explosive eruption, and this is, while it didn't look gentle, is a much more gentle type of eruption geologically. Just a couple of pictures that show some before and after shots to see the depth that this material covered the area. It's really quite amazing. Excuse me?
Oh, about 4 feet maybe, huh?
4 to 5 feet in area, that's right. And you can see the roofs in the background. Now, some houses were buried completely, but much of the town had to be excavated from beneath all of this ash and cinder. Well, as I said, the other thing that I wanted to talk about is how one can then use this heat from the volcanic material as a resource. And Iceland has done a terrific job of tapping this resource. As we saw from this earlier map, lots and lots of volcanic activity throughout Iceland, particularly along the drift zone. We were down in this region, but as we come up through here, all sorts of heat is revealed at the surface by a number of types of features. Very often, surface temperatures are somewhere on the order of 200 degrees Fahrenheit. So heat is manifested in a number of different ways. Where it comes up into muddy areas, we get these bubbling mud pots. This is a picture of one taken in Iceland. Similar features are seen all over the world. It depends on the material that it's coming up through as to whether it actually produces this mud pot. You can look across certain areas and simply see the steam escaping as it comes up through cracks at the surface. Sometimes building up small, what we call sinter, C-I-N-T-E-R, cones. The yellow is because this is very rich in sulfur. And a little later I'll talk about what a problem that can actually be. But features like this are observed in the United States, where we have hot material making it to the surface. Is that a question?
Those are like rotten eggs.
Yes. Yes. And also forming geysers. G-E-I-S-I-R is how it is spelled when we translate the Icelandic. And this is a geyser that reminds us very much of Yellowstone. Yellowstone is a very similar kind of a setting where there's a hot spot bringing heat to the surface. Now, Icelanders have harnessed this energy from the heat as a source to produce power, as what we call district heating.
The Icelanders or European people who have come over there, or people from Canada who have come to
Icelanders who migrated, now, do you know your husband's family's history? Were they from Europe originally?
We're interested in genealogy because there's so few of them. I think there are about 250,000.
Right. And most,
there were quite a few who came to Minnesota in 1874.
But when they moved to Iceland, my understanding is most of them had come from Europe to Iceland about 1,000 years ago.
You mean about, are you talking about the Vikings?
Well, I guess they were Vikings, but
they came from Norway.
Some also were Danish, I believe. This idea of district heating I'm going to come back to, where they simply pump heat to heat all sorts of different homes. This heat can also be used for growing things in the cold winters to heat greenhouses. For industrial processing, for drying, the heat is used to heat farming buildings. So there's a wide range of use of this heat that comes from the interior of the earth.
Why is it so barren? Why aren't there any trees there?
It's north, close to the Arctic Circle. Doesn't have a lot of sun to produce a lot of vegetation. Now, Reykjavik is the main city in Iceland, and it was there in southwestern Iceland that the first district heating service was established, where the hot water which is migrating through the volcanic rock, is actually pumped up to the surface and pumped into homes and used to heat those homes. I don't know how many of you know here in the village how these buildings are heated in the wintertime, but they burn wood to heat these buildings. And many of the chalets are on one very large loop where the furnace is located in chalet one, is stoked by wood, and the hot water then flows from one home into another and outside and back into another and so on, heating in essence a district of these little chalets here in Holden. Instead of heating just a few chalets, in Iceland there are somewhere on the order of 120,000 homes which are heated by this district heating. Not one single well provides the source for all of these, but from a number of holes drilled to a depth of about 400 feet, water temperature is close to 175 degrees. Each house is supplied off of a single water main that flows along. The water circulates through the home, returns to the water main, and then after the water has heated as many homes as are on a loop, it is pumped back into the ground. And that's a very important thing which is being done. The water is the resource which carries the heat into these homes. And if the water is not returned back into the ground, that resource will then dry up. 1930 was when the first pilot system was established. They connected 70 homes together with a hospital and a school, discovered that it was very successful. And by 1943, there were 2,300 houses heated, and at the present time, 99% of the homes in Reykjavik are heated by this means. That's about half the population of Iceland. Now, this same method of district heating is used in about 20 other areas of Iceland, including on the island of Heimaey that we saw before. On Heimaey, it's a difficult problem because there is not as much water which is in contact with the lava, and what they've had to do there is actually drill holes and pump the water into the lava and then extract it back out again after it's been heated. Only about 30 homes and a hospital are being heated there, which is only a very small area of the town, and as the lava cools, that heat resource diminishes. And so at some point, they will not be able to continue it as an economic fashion. Now, there are other areas of Iceland where they're actually harnessing the geothermal resources to do other things. This is a wonderful picture. This was early on in this century. They pumped the water out of holes in Reykjavik into common pools where people took their laundry to wash it. Must have smelled wonderfully. This is a picture up in the area of Krafla, with K-R-A-F-L-A, in northeastern Iceland, where there's a huge geothermal region. And in this area, the temperatures are high enough that they can actually use the steam which is produced to turn turbines and produce electricity from it. So they're actually generating power in this region. In Reykjavik, they're simply using that hot water as a source of heat, not actually to produce electricity, but just to keep the homes warm. Geothermal energy supplies about 40% of the total energy in Iceland. Heating from geothermal energy is in about 80% of all the homes total, and it only costs about 20% of what oil heating would cost. The rest of the energy in Iceland is supplied by hydroelectric power, and this is a picture of one of the very beautiful waterfalls in Iceland, but you can see that they have the right combination of water supply and relief to actually be able to drive turbines here and produce electricity as well. Now, since a lot of my focus this week is on environmental issues, Iceland just is a wonderful example of how they are able to tap very natural resources, what we talk about as primary resources. It hasn't, the energy hasn't gone through some conversion process from the sun to wood to be burned for a home. We're using it very directly, and it's much more efficient. It's also obviously very low on the pollution level. In the case of the hydropower, that's a renewable resource. The geothermal resource is always a little bit iffy as to whether it's going to be a renewable one or not, although it seems to be fairly successful here in Iceland. As I said before, though, the minerals in the water, in particular the sulfur, can be very destructive to the systems which are set up to extract this hot brine. One thing is that we get deposition of some of the minerals that are carried along, but the sulfur itself, when it combines with water, can be very corrosive. And so a lot of the pipes end up having to be replaced quite very frequently. The geysers area in California is one where efforts have been made in this country to tap that resource. And yet they have found that there it has dried up. There is simply not enough steam coming out anymore to drive as many turbines as they wanted. Question? And I think one of the problems there is that they are not returning the water back down in. And that's one of the wonders about the district heating, is that the water is being recycled so that that resource can continue to be used. At this point, this ends my formal talk here about Iceland and about McPhee's writings in this area. I could talk about John McPhee for hours. If people wanted to know some of the other things he's written, I could turn you towards some of those. But I hope that you've learned a little bit about the geology of Iceland and maybe even gotten a little bit interested in this author. I think Iceland is just a wonderful place that shows a lot of geology and useful ways in which that energy is harnessed. Thanks. But I'll answer any questions if you have. Yes.
It's not so much in Iceland where it's an expansion, but in California where you have an overlay, what effect has the water got on the lubrication of those plates?
Those in California, the plates are not overlying each other. The plates are sliding past one another. But yes, the water has been thought to do two things. In some areas where they have filled reservoirs and the water seems to seep down in, it does seem to lubricate the plates. In some areas where they extract the water, it seems to increase the activity at the plate boundary. So, seems to work both ways, California.
Now, question. When Xerxes erupted, then was that a movement of the plates?
Well, the plates there are moving apart, yes.
Okay.
And so if you have a region that's under tension and you have hot, molten material coming from below up to the surface, then it's the plates moving apart which allow that to make its way up to the surface.
So
but
the surface.
In California, the earthquakes make us very aware of the plates moving as they slide. Mm-hmm. And basically, the strain builds up and then it moves very abruptly. But where we have the plates moving apart, we don't have this sense of the tension and the jumps as they move apart. It's manifested more as the volcanic eruptions.
But they continue to have volcanic eruptions. Mount Hecla has erupted many times.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because the whole region has this source of hot material which is making its way up to the surface. It's another question. Yes.
I work in doing residential subdivisions and things like that, and we often in this, you know, Seattle Puget Sound area run into basalt, and it's characterized as either being fractured or weathered, but it's basically rock. Is this volcanic stuff?
Yes.
How can you describe the differences between a fractured and a weathered, and there's some other ways of describing it?
Well, the best way to describe it would be to actually look at it by example. Weathering is a surface process. And so the surface of the rock will be exposed to the elements and through time will disintegrate and produce soil or whatever. The fracturing tends to be something that penetrates down to greater depth. How many people here have been along the Columbia River Gorge and driven along the south side where there's the huge wall of rock and many waterfalls? And there the rock is fractured in this columnar way that was described in one of the readings. And that the fractures are then planes along which breakage takes place to some depth. So I think you're probably in some places seeing, and that's a cooling phenomenon more than a weathering phenomenon. And so you've probably seen some of both, the cooling and the weather. Other questions? Yes.
Last week you talked about the weight of the different types of material. You have the heavier materials make up the ocean floor type plate, and the lighter continental materials. Now, because the Iceland is right over a rift where new plate material is being generated, mm-hmm. is Iceland made up of the heavier material, or is it made up of the lighter continental material?
It is the heavier material.
It is the heavier
So what
material.
We have at Iceland is oceanic crust exposed to the surface.
And it's the only place that is?
That's really the only place. Mm-hmm. There are other places, it's basalt.
Mm-hmm.
And there are other places where basalt is exposed to the surface. I mean, some of the Cascades mm-hmm. have some basalt.
Right.
But if we take the overall composition of the continents, it is a much different composition on an average than oceanic crust, which is always basalt.
So it's not necessarily something different than any place else in the world as far as what the rocks are made up of.
That's correct.
It's just that that's all it's made up of.
That's right. And the processes that are going there, the combination of being on the ridge and then having also the isolated hot spot beneath mm-hmm. it make it very neat. Yes?
I have a question. In Iceland, where they hit all this ash, that 4 feet deep, What is it like? What is that ash? Is it like sand? And then what do you do with it? Do you just dump it in the ocean?
What do you do with it? Well, if you let it sit there for a couple hundred years, it turns into wonderfully fertile soil. But that wasn't helping that much.
Right.
It ranges in size from sand-sized all the way through all sorts of grades of sizes up to what we call volcanic bombs, which can be this is large in size. And what it is the molten material that was blown out in the lava fountains cools as small particles. And so sometimes it cools as small particles that are ash-sized, and sometimes fist-sized, and sometimes head-sized, and so on.
Okay, what about the density versus the volume? Is it like popcorn, in the sense that it's lighter?
Well, it's lighter not because it's a lighter material, but often because it has air trapped in it.
Okay.
Like pumice. I don't know how many of you ever picked up pumice. Pumice is very similar to ash, and it has a lot of air bubbles in it, and so it often floats in water, even though it's rock. But the density of the solid material is higher than water. It's just the trapped air makes it seem very light.
What proportion of the town was actually destroyed?
I think it was somewhere about a third. Are the Azores? Well, yes, they're quite similar to Iceland. They sit on the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, but they don't have a hot spot associated with them. They're just a few isolated small volcanoes that have made it to the surface. But if you remember one of those early slides that showed the ocean basins, if you drained all the water out, Iceland was a very large mass in comparison to the Azores, which are just sort of single peaks. Other questions? Yes.
I haven't heard any of your other talks, but you seem to lean towards environmental things as well.
Mm-hmm.
Are there ideas that you have for, let's say, this region or the United States as far as utilizing our natural resources more effectively?
Well, when I talked about energy yesterday, you can almost feel proud here in the Northwest because we are using a natural resource, a primary source of energy for so much of our energy in the form of electricity and hydropower. But we're very lucky that we can do that. It takes a lot of relief and water to be able to produce hydropower. You can't do that when you live in the flat plains or the arid parts of the country. We don't necessarily have the resources to do things like district heating of hot water because we don't have much of a source of heat right near the surface. So I think every area has to do whatever works best for them. And where there are geothermal resources to be harnessed, I would like to see that being done. And California has some of those. I don't know how many people here have ever been in the Mammoth Lakes area of California. you know, on the east side of the Sierra Mountains there, there's a big ski resort. That's where Mono Lake is. And there is a wonderful little geothermal plume that comes up to the surface. And there's a creek which is heated by it. And you can go out and swim in it. I mean, it's, you know, it's a natural jacuzzi. And there, they could be heating, they could be harnessing that energy. And in fact, they use it in fish farming there, although they don't use it in terms of any home. So I think that it doesn't work in this area if you don't have that resource readily available.
The hot springs, that there are a number of them around this area.
Very small.
They're all pretty small though, right? Is that unusual, or is that characteristic of us being in a volcanic region?
Yes. We would expect there would be some, and one of my colleagues at PLU actually is very interested in looking at what geothermal resources there are in the state of Washington. And if they could be tapped, then that would be great, but they may be at depths which are too great or to be useful. But if it's there, we have it more than the people in the east do, because that is not an active volcanic area.
Okay.